Good afternoon, good morning, I guess since we're crossing all time zones, this is Susan King. I'm your host of Where Genealogy and Spirit Connect. And as usual, I am very excited to be here with everybody once again. The shows over the last 13 weeks, I think that's where we are, have absolutely been outstanding, and the guests have been outstanding, and today is no exception. So for those of you who might be interested in your immigrant ancestors, this is the show to be tuned to, and we will get right in with our guest here in just a few minutes. Sit back and listen to some of my favorite steel drum music, being a steel drummer on the side. And there we go. I am very, very fortunate today to have someone with me that I have worked with, I guess, for, I looked at it, Peg, and I think we go back about 9 years now.
But, long time.
It has been a long time. But Peg and I met many years ago when she was with the Statue of Liberty Ellis Island Foundation, and they were just getting ready to launch their major database. And she's been with them ever since, and she has been very active in developing and directing all the national media campaigns to raise awareness for the Ellis Island restoration and to promote the Ellis Island Immigration Museum, the American Immigrant Wall of Honor, and really to launch the new groundbreaking family history research site. So also there's a new project, too, that you've launched, and we're going to get into that in just a minute. Peg, it's been very exciting what you guys have done over the last, I don't know how many years. When did you actually start working with Ellis Island on all of these projects?
Well, I've been with the foundation since 83. I always tell my boss I gave him the best years of my life. but the work back in 1982, we'll cast our minds way back. The Statue of Liberty was really in need, serious need of repair. And President Reagan wanted the American people to do it, not congressional funds. So he appointed Lee Iacocca, who you know at the time was the head of the Chrysler Corporation, to lead up a private sector effort to raise the funds for and restore the Statue of Liberty and Ellis Island. And so in 1982, the foundation was started. Actually, the Centennial Commission was started, filled with folks who were going to guide the restoration, and then the foundation was started as the day-to-day fundraising and operational arm for the commission. And the work began, and the statue centennial was in 1986, and we actually had the statue restored in time for her centennial, which we celebrated with Liberty Weekend.
I remember that.
Which was seen around the country, yeah.
Yeah, I remember that.
And around the world, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
The tall ships came to town, right. That was an $87 million restoration.
Wow.
All the money came from the American people. No government funds. Actually, to date, we have had no government funds involved.
That's incredible. With
the projects that we've done. And to date, we've raised over $550 million.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. You know, having been involved in the nonprofit world, that is an incredible feat. Now, the genealogists are interested, I think, in what really transgressed, I think, at the launch of www.ellisisland.org in April of 2001. And that was probably a major, major availability of records that had not heretofore been available to genealogists, especially those who are researching immigrant ancestors.
That's right. You know, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to step back for a second just to sort of set up this discussion of the Family History Center.
Okay.
You know, after we finished the Statue of Liberty, then we turned our attention to restoring the main building at Ellis Island, which was the largest historic restoration in American history. And in that building, we created the Ellis Island Immigration Museum, which, you know, told the story of immigration to this country primarily during the peak immigration years of 1880 to 1924, Ellis Island having opened in 1892. During all that time, during the late 80s up until, and the museum opened in September of 1990, we had always talked about the interest in bringing the immigration records to Ellis Island. They were at the time, as you know, on microfilm at the National Archives.
Right.
And there was an interest even back then in making them more accessible to people. But it was so cost prohibitive back in the late 80s because technology had not gotten to where it's gotten.
Sure.
That we simply had to table that discussion for a while and put our focus really on creating the museum. And the museum alone, the restoration and the creation of the museum, was about another $161 million project. So now you add that on to the $87 million we had with the statue, and things were, you know, we were in need of raising some funds.
Absolutely.
And getting the museum done. And we did, actually. And one of the things, I'm trying to do this sort of chronologically so it all makes sense, it hangs together.
Sure.
One of the ways, towards the end, we still had a shortfall. We needed money to raise funds to complete the museum. Lee Iacocca had this idea of giving people back something, a little piece of Ellis Island. His folks both his parents came through Ellis Island. So he said, you know what, we should create a wall out here where people can place their ancestor's name or their family name to celebrate their family's arrival in America. So we created what we call the American Immigrant Wall of Honor.
Right.
And we really we created in 87, really launched it in early 88, and we thought we'd maybe get 50,000 names. Well, to date, we have over 700,000 names.
Wow.
The wall, we raised over $70 million through our Wall of Honor. It's become a very emotional memorial to people. Many, many people visit Ellis Island to see their family name on the wall, and then, of course, to take in the museum.
Right.
So we did that. So we finished the museum in 1990, and then, you know, in the next couple of years after that, we did some expansion of the museum. You know, we created a children's learning center and that sort of thing. But we kept thinking about genealogy, with bringing these I wouldn't say even genealogy, but these immigration records, the desire to bring immigration records to Ellis. And technology, as you know, was growing and improving.
Right.
Along the way. So by the mid-90s, it was about 95 that we got serious about it, and our board said, and with the Park Service, made this agreement, you know what, the time has come, let's do this. We're going to create a center at Ellis Island where you will be able to, on a computer, access the immigration records. Now, mind you, we weren't thinking about the Internet at all
right.
at this point.
Right.
Not at all. We were just talking about having a family history center at Ellis Island. And we got in a partnership with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, who, as you know, is
right.
very involved, leaders in the field of genealogy. And we had 12,000 church volunteers from 2,700 of their congregations throughout the United States and Canada extracting the data from the microfilm to create an index for us for our database. They actually they donated approximately 5.6 million volunteer hours.
Wow.
To create our database. And our database has about 25 million individual entries, you know, for individuals. And we can talk about that in more detail later, but we were planning on opening the center sometime in 2001, right? But by that time, by like around 98, 99,
yes.
The Internet was really taking off, and we realized, you know, we got to put this thing on the Internet. The church was at first resistant.
Okay.
They were not so interested in putting the records on the Internet. I think there was a little fear of the Internet at the time.
Sure.
But it didn't take long, and we came into an agreement that we would make these records available both online and at Ellis Island. And that's exactly what we did. We opened this records database. It was the American Family Immigration History Center at Ellis Island and ellisisland.org on the Internet. And, well, you know, it was April 17th, 2001, is a day that we'll live in infamy and celebration. We knew it was going to be popular, but we had no idea. I have some little figures that stats that I got together because I thought it'd be interesting for you and your audience.
I think so.
The website launched at 6 p.m. on April 17th and successfully served 8 million hits in the first 6 hours.
Wow.
It was serving, and I know this because we had so much media coverage back then. It was crazy. And a lot of technology writers who we didn't normally deal with because we had no technology news in the past. The thing was getting 27,000 hits per second in the first couple of days.
Right.
27 on hits per second. And actually, there's another actually interesting and funny part of the story, which I think you know, but you may not. Our website, our official website, which we had had for the years before that, which was more kind of an electronic brochure about the foundation and our projects, was ellisisland.org. We thought we were being smart, and we were going to have a separate URL for the record center, and the website was going to be ellisislandrecords.org.
Uh-huh.
So we had our own little electronic brochure website, ellisisland.org, on a small server situation that we had, you know? And then we had lined up a bigger capability, because we knew it would be popular,
right,
for ellisislandrecords.org. Well, the media, in publishing and talking about the website, just dropped the word records.
Oh my
gosh. So they were driving people to ellisisland.org. Our little server scenario over in New Jersey, the guys like pulling out their hair. We knew immediately that we couldn't handle it. So we redirected Ellis Island Records to Ellis Island. You know, we switched the designation for both of them. Basically, we merged it into one and went to the bigger service, but we knew within a day or so that we needed a bigger server farm, which we ultimately started building as quickly as we could to accommodate the traffic.
And that is amazing. And just out of curiosity, has that hit level pretty much remained steady throughout these?
Well, you know, nothing will stay that high for that long. We now get, in a month, a typical month, well, summer's probably a little less than the winter. I pulled up the figures for the last month, June 20th to July 20th. We're getting about 500,000 visits a month. And our hits are, it's not as much, but it's still one of the most popular genealogy sites online. What's interesting is, you know, we've had, like in a month, we'll get, you know, 7 to 8 million page views.
Right.
Our bounce rate's relatively low, about 24%. And we're quite sticky. People stay at an average of 9 minutes. It's a pretty long time.
Okay. That is a long
time. And typically, they'll go to as many as 16 to 17 pages, which is also pretty, you know, people come to the site and they stay.
Right.
Because, particularly, obviously, if they're researching, they're going to need to spend a little bit of time. And it's, you know, it does sort of, well, who knows better than you? It draws you in.
It does. And
once you start that searching.
Right. And sometimes you even get lost in records of people that you have absolutely no connection with.
That's true too, right.
I mean, it is. I mean, you know, going back, and I mean, you know, since the title of my show is Where Genealogy and Spirit Connected, having, done quite a bit of research on immigration and immigrant, and having immigrant ancestors myself, you know, I just always ponder, the stories behind, you know, what brought these people to this place, what, you know, made them leave, and having had the opportunity to visit some of these ancestral villages of mine that are just absolutely gorgeous in most cases.
Yeah, what a great thing you have to visit.
And the sadness that must have existed, too, of leaving something that, all you knew to, you know, because of whether it, we have religious persecution, so be it, or famine, or plague, or political unrest. I mean, God only knows what forced people to leave some of these gorgeous.
Those were the big reasons, though. The ones you just stated were the big ones.
Those were the only reasons. And,
right.
And I know from the types of research, as far as different types of genealogy research, I mean, what would you say is the biggest target audience? Would it be Irish, Jewish, Italian? Can you even identify?
You know, I really can't. Well, first of all, the largest group that came through Ellis Island is Italian.
Okay.
So clearly we have a lot of Italians, certainly in the database, you know, and they know their families, you know, would have good chance of them coming through Ellis in the Port of New York. Our records are not just for Ellis, you know, it's the Port of New York.
Right.
So to get back to the 25 million records we have, those aren't all immigrants. 12 million immigrants actually set foot on Ellis Island. Those are the folks who came in the bottom of the boat, who came steerage, and were made to go to Ellis Island to basically be cleared. They wanted to make sure, the Immigration and Naturalization Service at the time wanted to make sure people were not bringing in communicable diseases and that they would not have a way of making a living and become, you know, wards of the state, as they called it back then, or for us it would be on welfare.
Right.
So those folks were made to come through Ellis Island. Another 5 million immigrants came first or second class. And those were processed either on board ship or at the docks on the Hudson River or on the East River.
Right.
Or even in Hoboken. There were some that docked in Hoboken.
Okay.
So that brings you up to 17 million. And then there were another 8 million records on, you know, on the manifest records of people who were traveling, ship's crew members. So it's, we have kind of a wide variety of records in there. So even if you're not looking for immigrant ancestors, there's some interesting stuff you can find in our database. Like, for example, if you go on our website, and you, if you go on ellisisland.org, we have on our drop-down menu, famous arrivals is a selection you can make. And those are folks, those are records that are in our database marking presidents who are traveling. You know, if they came through the port of New York on a ship, they're going to be on a manifest. And it's just kind of fun to see who's traveling. We have famous Carl Jung. We have, you know, Sigmund Freud, Sergei Rachmaninoff. Some were immigrants, some weren't. Herbert Hoover came. You know, just it's interesting.
It is.
And, so, and that's what makes up the database.
Now, as far as what one would find if one goes and is looking for something on in the database, what type of data you know, has been indexed, and you know, as far as that, and my, yeah, you know, from what I know, of course, because I've used it quite a bit, is that, you know, not only can you, you know, get an index, but you can actually see the passenger manifest.
Exactly, and we were the first to do that.
And
to my knowledge,
that gives a lot of information in a lot of cases.
That's exactly right. The earlier manifest from like the turn of the century had about only 13 fields of information. But right just past the turn of the century, they started adding questions because the U.S. government wanted to know more about these folks who were coming in. So it went up to about 26 fields of information. And what happened was the ship's crew, stop me if this is too much detail, but
no,
the ship's clerk on the other side in Europe, you know, at the port of debarkation,
sure,
had this big ledger. And as the passengers came forward, they were asked this series of questions, which the ship's clerk hand wrote, usually,
uh-huh,
into the book, which was the ship's manifest. And the passengers and the books were put on the ship, came across, came to the port of New York. The books came off at Ellis Island, and the immigration inspectors had those manifests in the Great Hall at Ellis Island, and the immigrants would be called up line by line, page by page, line by line, and they were asked the same questions they were asked on the other side, and they would look to make sure the answers were the same, to make sure this was the same person who came over. So in creating the database, we knew, like, the church actually really helped to design this. They primarily did design the index. They wanted to make sure they had to pick fields of information for the index that were going to be appearing on all the manifests across those years, 1890 to 1924.
Right.
So they landed on 11 fields that were uniformly across those years and also, you know, gave enough information so that you could start kind of narrowing your search. So what it is 11 fields of information on the index, which we on our site, we call it the passenger record.
Right.
And that's the first name, the last name, the ethnicity, the last place of residence, the date of arrival, the age at arrival, the gender, the marital status, the ship of travel, the port of departure, and then the line on the manifest where their information can be found. And once you, if you do a search and you find the person, you can click on the passenger record to get that information I just stated. Then you can click over, because what we did was we paid to have all those microfilm pages also scanned.
Right.
So that you could digitally look at them. And so then you can click over and actually see reproductions, you know, a scanned copy of the original manifest. With all the, let's say, 26 fields of information, which can be absolutely fascinating, it can be as specific as where they left from, the person they left behind, let's say their mother and her address, their occupation, how much money they had in their pockets, where they were going, who they were going to meet, and the down to the exact address,
exactly.
If they had it.
Yeah.
Also things like, if they were a polygamist, if they were an anarchist. You know, we always laugh here and say it's similar to traveling now and you're at the airport and they ask you, did you pack your own bag? You know, did you
right.
put explosives in? I mean, is anybody actually going to say, yeah, I'm a polygamist or I'm an anarchist?
Right.
We don't know how many people actually said that. But so anyway, you have those fields of information, height, weight, hair color, eye color, all of that. So it's, you can really start to paint the picture of your ancestor with the data that you've gotten just from the manifest. It's a treasure trove, really.
It really is. And going back to the early days, like you said, I mean, you were one of the first to put the records online. I mean, there almost every company now that has collections of genealogy records, is doing the same. In fact, I think we may, when I was with Jewish Gen, we may have been the first when we put the breast ghetto records online with the images of those people who had signed, which was really a very emotional thing. And
absolutely.
I think that was early in the, probably the mid to late 1990s, I think. I know it was one of the first that we had used.
Oh, well, then yours was up even before ours, right?
Oh, yeah. We had, it wasn't a whole lot. I mean, it wasn't
the
anything
smaller
like
data,
this.
Yeah, right.
Very small database, but it provided an opportunity for people who had relatives in the breast ghetto during the war to actually see their signatures. So, that I don't know about other people, and I might be one of these. I consider myself an empath. I see that, and I see where they were at a particular time and how they signed a document, and it does all kinds of funny things to me and making me funny feelings.
Oh, no, I agree with you. I have to tell you, you said the word emotional before, and it is a real emotional journey for folks. I can tell you firsthand by seeing people using our record center out at Ellis Island, where we have computers there that you can use to do this research. And it's actually, it's a very nice experience out there. It's a broadband experience. So it's more of a video that kind of pulls you in.
Right.
And invites you kind of into it and sort of walks you through it. So for a novice, it's a nice place to start because we have staff out at the island to help you. And they kind of know their ways around, tricks for helping you better find, your ancestors. But people there are extremely emotional. I've seen many, many grown men just break down in tears.
Tears.
When they see that data come up on the screen, it's just visceral. They have a visceral reaction to it.
It is. And the closer you are, I mean, we're kind of getting a little bit generationally removed, I think, as the years go on, and a lot more so, I guess, in the last 10 years than we were prior to that. So that being, removed generationally from the experience, what is so important, is that people continue to, remember these people who really gave gave up so much. I mean, just think about how it would be. I mean, I've thought about it myself, if all of a sudden, the Indian tribe who once owned this little piece of land that I live on in Texas decided, they wanted to take it back, and I was
time for you to go,
and I had to leave, and I didn't know where I was going to go, and I'm only using that reference only because that's where this land came from, but that's what these people dealt with, and people, just I just couldn't begin to fathom how I would feel and where I would go and what I would do and the strength of these people to take these long voyages and with nothing. I mean, nothing.
And also remember, they didn't speak the language, so they came over here not knowing what people were saying.
Right. So they
didn't add that to it. Like, would you move to Hungary? Without, you know what I'm saying? No, it's very hard for us today to put ourselves in their shoes. You know, yes, many of them felt like when you ask, you know, we have a very, very important oral history library at Ellis Island. Going back again into the 80s when we knew we were going to be restoring Ellis Island, we knew that the oral record was an important one to keep. And if we didn't get on it fast, these people who came through Ellis were all going to be dead.
Right.
So even while we were just working on the beginnings of the Statue of Liberty restoration and hadn't even done serious work at Ellis, we started identifying Ellis Island immigrants and having our researchers and our interviewers interview them, get their oral histories for inclusion in the center. We have about probably 1,800 oral histories representing all the ethnicities that came through Ellis Island in addition to, I said 1,800, right? Yeah, so I think
right.
It's either, it's close to 2,000. And also workers, people who worked at the island.
Wow.
Very important to get there. But many of them would say, well, I didn't have a choice. I had to come.
Right.
It still took a lot of guts and determination and real willpower. You know, there we have some great quotes from the immigrants in the museum, right up on the walls. And there's one from Golda Meir who said when she left her mother said, you know, it's like you're going to the moon. I'll never see you again. You know, travel wasn't what it is today. When
no.
people left to come to America, that was, in many cases, very much it. They never saw their family behind again. Now,
right.
in other cases, it wasn't. The Italians, as you know, frequently, the husband would come over just to work. He wasn't looking to emigrate. They were coming over here looking for labor. So, come over, send money home, and go back. Like Iacocca's father came three times. The last time he brought his wife. He came as a young man. He went back. I think he may have met his wife before he came back the second time, and then when he went back the third time, I think he married her and then brought her over.
Uh-huh.
But for many, many, they never saw their families again.
Right. And that too is just, I don't know, I get upset about that.
Well,
so even when I do research on the site,
for other people.
Even for other people, I get a little emotional going through the records. Now, you know, over the years, you know, what people don't really understand is that when people came in through Ellis Island, names were changed.
No.
Names were spelled differently.
Famous misconception. Names were not changed at Ellis Island by standard operating procedure. That did not happen. Many people change their names, but
That's
they change them at the point of naturalization.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because that is a very common misconception.
It is
that names were changed at Ellis Island.
But I mean, the spellings were changed. I mean, when they came in, they said my name is Korenstein. It may have been spelled Orenstein or Horenstein or, you know, it could have been spelled way different than what they may have said.
Well, it went by whatever was on the ship's log, which was written by the ship's clerk on the other side.
Right.
Names were not changed at Ellis. I mean, if they were changed, it was inadvertent. It was because actually they didn't leave Ellis with any kind of document where a clerk would have written their name anew. You know what I'm saying?
Uh huh.
So it was really whatever was in that manifest. That was the name that was recorded for them. And then the immigrant could turn around and decide to change their name, you know, just start going by another name that was more American. And many of them, as I said, did change their name, spelling and pronunciation, at the time of naturalization because they wanted to have a name that was easier to pronounce, easier to spell, and that maybe sounded more American.
Right.
But many really wanted to shed their nationality. They wanted to be American.
But even on the Italian side, there were names that would come over that might be DeMiro, that may have been shortened to Miro. I mean, I've seen so many cases of in research. Now, you know, where it was shortened, you're right. We really don't know if it was.
Oh, they were shortened, yeah. It's just that they weren't typically shortened at Ellis Island. That's
right.
The only thing.
So
I think they may drop it.
Go ahead.
I think they may have dropped it themselves or when they got employment. Whoever, you know, like was writing down the name, you know, for their employment records, maybe dropped the DE or, you know?
Yeah.
For DeMuro and it became Muro.
So when you give tips for people who are just now, you know, just starting and they type in their family name as they think it's to be and they don't find anything, you know, is there any particular tips that you would offer them? I know I have some that I do, but from your perspective.
Oh, yeah. Actually, on our website, under passenger search, there's a drop-down menu, and there's a search tips link that kind of search, you know, helps people. We also have a functionality on the website that allows for, like, sounds like, almost like a Soundex. It's not Soundex, but like that, so that you can get a range of begins with, sounds like, that sort of thing. We also frequently tell people, as far as first name goes, either don't use it, but sometimes there's so many last names, somebody people by that surname that you need to narrow it down.
Right.
We'll suggest only put the first initial.
Right.
And for example, like with Eastern European Jews, for example, many of them, for example, even my husband's great grandmother, her name, she came from Russia as like a young girl, 17 maybe. Her name was Jenny Whitman. Now, Jenny is not a Russian name.
No.
So I said to his grandmother, I don't think, well, her name probably wasn't Jenny. So then she goes, well, I think it was Shainsa. Well, Shainsa's a lot different than Jenny.
Sure.
You know? So if you're looking for Jenny Whitman, it's not going to come up. But if you're looking, then the problem with Shainsa is, well, that's, how do you spell that? And I will say our search is by name. So you have to have the right name. But we do have tools for helping you kind of get to the right, you know, having your search be broad enough that the choices will come up that you should be able to find what you're looking for. You may have to plow through. I mean, it's not an exact science, and as you know, it can take a long time. But if you're tenacious, you can get to the bottom of it. And I will say, a lot of folks using our site and the center at Ellis, they'll find the name almost right away. Sometimes it's almost instantaneous. It comes right up.
Right.
Other times not so, you know?
Right. And the other thing, too, that people don't do is, you know, they don't they don't look at the whole manifest once they find their family because, you know, it's very likely that there might be other family members that were traveling at the same time. And, you know, it's best, you know, when you find something to really kind of study the whole ship list because you just never know what you're going to find. And
well, you bring up a good point also, Susan, and that is that we always ask people to find out, did the person you're looking for travel with someone else? Did they come alone? Did they travel? Because sometimes if you know, even if you don't know names, if you know they came, let's say, with their mother and three siblings, then the person you're looking for specifically, let's say your grandfather, that name may not come up, but you're going to see people with a certain surname, and it's like, oh, there's a mother with four kids coming from the town I think they came from. You know what? It's helpful.
It is.
If they're coming in groups.
And I can quote an example. I have an immigrant that came over. I understood his name to be Max Ainbinder, and he had a wife that was Anna and a son that was Lewis, and a son that was Mayor, and a son and a daughter who was Cecile, and so forth and so on. I find the listing, and the last name is Ainbinder with an E, not an A.
Right.
And his name was Mendel, and his wife's name was Anna or Hannah, and the sons' names were Laser instead of Lewis, and I mean it went on and on and on. But
right,
you know, I could look at the record and see that this was the family.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, it does require a little bit of information processing, rather than just a straight hit.
The more information you can have, even if it seems like extraneous, it can be helpful. For example, when we opened the center on September 17th of 2001, we had the Today Show live out at the island. So we were doing the genealogy, or trying to search for the records of all the anchors for the Today Show. And we were looking for Matt Lauer's grandfather who came through. And We couldn't find, it was grandfather came to the child, and then great-grandfather we were looking for. We could not find him, And then, but we knew that the grandmother came separately with all the kids. So somehow we got, and I don't think he even knew what her name was, but by looking for Lauer, we ended up finding her with all the kids. And we're like 5 or 6 kids.
Right.
And then from there, it said on her manifest who they were going to meet, and it was him.
Right.
So I think we ultimately were able to find him, but, you know, it's just, if you can, it's a circuitous route, but it's, you're right in saying that you really need to pay attention to the manifest.
And, you know, interestingly enough, and I mean, you know, Ancestry.com has begun to do some of the naturalization records. And
oh, that's
being
right.
Able to compare, and if you can't find the passenger record, I had a situation recently where we weren't able to find the passenger record, but we found the naturalization record. And because of that naturalization record, we actually have been able to go in and find the passenger record on Elk.
Exactly. Sometimes it's kind of backwards. You
it
think
is.
You do frequently you do the logical path would be find the immigration the passenger record and then go from there to the naturalization, but sometimes you have to go the other way around.
Right.
Yeah, you learn all the tricks.
And one of the other things that I think is difficult for a lot of people, and you know, even for those who have been in the research field for a long time, is the spelling of the names of the places that they came from, and especially over in Eastern Europe. And
right.
I mean, this is, yeah, I mean, it's nothing that y'all have done that is wrong, nothing that the people that, you know, made these manifests did that was wrong. It's just that, you know, there are millions and millions of small villages all over the world that these people came from, and they all had different accents, and they said, I came from Goten, and they spelled it one way. And
all right.
They may be a totally different town. I mean, or there might be 5 or 6 of them of the same name. I mean, my family, for example, came from Vorderduk, and there are 11 of them all over Eastern Europe. I mean, small town. So, you know, isolating the town, even though you think you've got it, you know, sometimes is very fluid, and sometimes is not.
Well, you know, who knows better than Jewish Jen? We learned a lot in the process of, you know, we never claim to be genealogists. You know, we are a fundraising organization working
right.
with the Park Service on, you know, the restorations and creating the museum. So with the help, we did have the help, obviously, of historians and genealogists to create our database. But we certainly learned along the way, and as we could, we made improvements to the site, and we did, we took your advice and the guidance of Jewish Den, and we did get alternate spellings on all those towns.
Right.
Which I knew you guys were really pros at, so that now you can, a town will come up under a variety of spellings, which they do. On the manifest, there's so many different spellings of some of those Russian towns and Polish towns in particular.
Right. And even at that, you still have to do, you know, do some further research. And, you know, there's probably one of the best databases to help you do that on Jewish Gen, and that's the community's database. Whether or not it's in, in Eastern Europe in Jewish section or in regular Europe, I mean, that database is probably one of the most widest used and was up, it was one of the earlier databases, too, that was put up. That allowed you to find places in Europe and Eastern Europe based on phonetic and you know, spellings of sorts. So
important. Oh yeah.
With maps,
I know,
that you can pinpoint. You know, I mean, even Family Tree Maker today has that feature in its software program.
Well,
and
now
online.
Can't you actually search on Jewish Gen? You can actually search by the town.
Yes,
because
you can.
Didn't you say people, many people, Jewish in particular, like they know the town their family came from. They may not even know how their name was spelled, but they know the town. So if you can get a listing of people in that town, they could find. Isn't that how that works?
Well, basically, the way Jewish Gen was set up is that we had there was a lot of integration by town and country names, and not so much by surnames. And
I see.
You know, the Jewish research really if you can find somebody that was lived, yeah, that came from the same town, there's a likelihood of that there is some relational connection there, either by marriage or by something. And, you know, most of these small towns in Eastern Europe and Poland had, now, I mean, you get into the big cities, you know, forget it, but the little towns, you know, they had maybe a population of several hundred Jews at the time of immigration, and, you know, it becomes a process of connecting to other people who are researching a particular place that might very well guide you to finding distant cousins and things like that. And, you know, especially, you know, during the major mass emigration during World War II, was, you know, a lot of people left, and they left, and a lot of people, unfortunately, didn't end up in the United States either, because
right.
there was a limitation on how many people we would accept. So a lot
there
of
there were quotas,
ended up,
right?
Ended up in South America. And
South America,
up,
right?
And Israel.
That was, it's amazing. I've learned a lot of this stuff since I've been involved with this project. I mean, there was this whole community, rather large community of Jewish people in Texas, and I thought, how'd the Jews get to Texas? I always thought they were all on the eastern seaboard, you know. Well,
yeah.
a lot of them came up through South America. The boats went to South America. The family stayed there maybe for a generation or more, and then made their way up through Galveston.
Yes. And Galveston was, you know, a very major hub, and unfortunately, you know, for us down here near Galveston, you know, we the Texas Maritime Museum, which has all the passenger ship records, has been closed since Hurricane Ike, which is coming up on a year. It's hard to believe. So,
how many years now?
It's been, yeah. Ike came through here a year ago.
Oh, wow.
Really devastated Galveston. So a lot of our research facilities, I mean, they weren't ruined, but they, you know, are not up and functioning yet.
They're indisposed, right?
Yes. So a lot of the information on Galveston immigrations is currently not available, but they did.
Right.
And then there was, during a period, a very big migration of boats that just didn't land in New York and ended up, you know, down in Galveston and Port of New Orleans. And so, you know, it's an interesting, yeah, I mean, the migration pattern, I mean, you specifically are between, you know, records are between 1892 and 1924.
Yeah, and we picked those because those were the peak years. I mean, the immigration that Ellis Island and the Port of New York saw was the largest human migration in modern history. There's an exhibit at the museum that shows the immigration ports, I think, in 1907. And Ellis Island is just head and shoulders above any other port. But there are, you know, that comes like the Port of Baltimore and Philadelphia. Ellis was the first federal facility, federal immigration port,
okay.
or facility. Subsequently, quick history lesson, pre-Ellis Island, all the states were doing, pre-1890, the states had their own immigration processing facilities. But immigration had grown to such a huge number that the federal government said, we gotta take this over. There have to be some more controls.
Right.
On immigration. So they made Ellis Island the first federal facility and subsequently built opened additional federal facilities in, you know, all the major port cities, Baltimore, Philadelphia, Boston, etc. All the way down to Beaufort, South Carolina also had they accepted like two immigrants in 1907.
that's
a friend of mine's from Beaufort, so I just laugh about that.
Yeah, that's funny. Anyway, before we get into, I think, the newest project, I wanted to go ahead and give out a toll-free number if anybody has any questions for Peg. And that number is 888-815-9756, and that's available for anybody in the world, so it's worldwide. And so, you know, if we get any questions, we will take those, but in the meantime, this new project sounds pretty fascinating to me, and I think that it builds on some of the new interactivity that's going on in the whole social networking internet arena these days. So you want to explain your new project,
yeah.
American Flag of Faces?
Yes, well, I'm going to put it in a framework, actually, for you.
Okay.
We're actually working on a our newest project is called the Peopling of America Center. It's going to be an expansion of the Ellis Island Museum. Right now the museum focuses on those peak years, mostly on the Ellis experience, but also kind of generally. But there is, the Park Service has had a desire across the board, nationally. They want to make the parks more relevant to the broader population that is America today. And our board's always felt that way. So this new center is going to kind of bookend the Ellis Island era. We're going to tell the pre-Ellis Island story, going all the way back to the earliest arrivals. And then we're going to pick up and tell the post-Ellis Island story, kind of from World War II right up to the present.
Okay.
It's going to be really dynamic. It's going to make a trip to Ellis Island that much more relevant to, really, there's so many folks who've been coming. We get about 2 million visitors a year to the Ellis Island Museum.
Okay.
So that's, what is that, since 1990? We're talking 35 million people, give or take. And everybody, it's a wonderful museum, and everybody can relate to it in some way, but a lot of folks will say, kids in particular, but my story's not told here. So we're going to tell those stories. We're going to tell the entire story of the population of America. And then when we open the center, it's scheduled to be open in 2011. The name of the museum is going to change to Ellis Island, the National Museum of Immigration.
Okay.
So that's very exciting. And one of the exhibits in that center is going to be what we're calling the American Flag of Faces.
Okay.
And this is an interactive exhibit that's now working. It's online right now at flagoffaces.org. Where people can upload with a donation. It's a way for us to also, like we did with our Wall of Honor, help us raise the last money that we need to complete the center. You can upload a photograph. It can be a picture of yourself. It could be a picture of your kids, of your family. It could be a picture of your ancestors that become a part of this virtual flag on the Internet. And then when we're going to start construction of the center probably by September.
Okay.
When we get to the point when we're going to build that part of the center, the post-Ellis story, this will become a major exhibit in the post-Ellis Island era.
Okay.
And it's going to be this kind of hologrammatic sort of big virtual flag at Ellis Island, you know, wall size, that people will be able to come. And then if they've added a picture on the flag, there'll be a kiosk where they can pull it up and it will like fly up and sort of predominate the whole screen.
How fun.
And then go back. So
right.
It is. It's we're getting it. We just launched it, you know, kind of quietly in the last couple of months, and there's some interest. So I'd urge your listeners to go to flagoffaces.org and check it out. We think it's pretty interesting, and the people who have participated are very excited about it.
It sounds really interesting to me too, and I guess one of these days I need to dig up some of my stuff and you know. Memorialize.
Dig up your family picture. Yeah, you should.
And
it can be contemporary. It can be your ancestors. A lot of people have actually uploaded their ancestors' pictures. But we really want folks to feel like this is really a celebration of being an American today, yesterday, and tomorrow. So a lot of folks are also putting up their own pictures, their family, their contemporary family pictures. Pictures
right.
from the last holiday, pictures from a graduation. It's a great gift, as we've always said, really about our wall, too. It's a great gift for an anniversary or for a birthday or for Mother's Day. It's just meaningful. You know, so many folks have things they don't need anymore. They don't need more stuff.
Right.
And in the economic climate that we're in now, you know, it's nice to be able to give something that's particularly meaningful and for posterity and that you know you're helping a nonprofit. Can't hurt.
No,
it's a triple play.
It can't. And, you know, they always say, you know, the more you give, the more you get. So
there you go.
Giving a little bit for, you know, the preservation of history and the history, something of your family.
Right.
And helping, you know, preserve, you know, the history of, you know, the country and the immigration process and freedom, I think, is really what we're looking at.
That's what we're talking about. And also, you know, while the people in Congress today don't have a direct relation to Ellis Island, in the mind's eye, when you talk about immigration in this country, people think about Ellis Island.
Right.
Even the new immigrants. It's so taught in the schools. Or they certainly think about the Statue of Liberty.
Right.
And the Statue of Liberty is so entwined with Ellis Island and the immigrant experience. So it becomes more symbolic. Ellis becomes the symbol of American immigration.
Yeah. You know, I can tell you that I've flown to, you know, Eastern Europe and to China and all over the world, and I will tell you there is nothing more meaningful. And I, here goes my empath thing again. Well, you don't do it as often as you did back when, but when we would get into our landing pattern and fly over that Statue of Liberty, I would cry.
I know.
Because I, you know, it really does have, it means so much. And it means so much to so many. And if you think about those people that came in on those boats, who left everything, and
right.
they saw this beautiful woman standing there, you know, pretending for, you know, for your freedom. I mean, I just can't imagine the emotion that it's kind of overwhelming to me.
Well, you know, we hear it again to talk about the oral histories. We hear that from the oral history all the time. People are talking about how, you know, they're moved to tears. I mean, and those clips are used in the exhibits too, where people talk about, you know, Lady Liberty and she was welcoming them she was a symbol of America and a symbol of welcome, you know. Another thing actually I want to get in here quickly is that we have, because we're talking about the museums, both at the Statue
right.
and Ellis, we've launched just recently, the foundation launched a new audio tour for both sites. And for the first time, we've really incorporated a lot of the oral history clips in it. So you kind of, at Ellis, on the oral history tour, you really kind of, or the audio tour, you're kind of going through Ellis as kind of as if it's walking the immigrant steps. So it's a really, it's a more meaningful than the old, the past audio tours have been.
Right.
And it's nice because you don't need a whole lot of time to do it. You can spend a lot of time. There are additional features to the audio tour, so you could spend hours if you wanted to. But the basic tour is about 45 minutes at Ellis. And it's about 30 at the statue. So if you don't have much time when you come, but you want to have a really full experience, the audio tour is a really interesting and really effective thing to get.
Here's a crazy idea for you.
What's that?
Well, maybe it would be kind of cool to incorporate some of those audio interviews.
Your history, yeah.
On the website, not where they can just get to them, but maybe, you know, every once in a while, if you can link them to, you know, if someone came in, you know, if somebody was researching someone that immigrated from Italy, that, you know, there would be a random selection of something that might have some meaning to them that might incorporate some of these things that I think would be very beneficial to users who may not be able to get to Ellis Island. Or
yeah, well, that's actually a very interesting idea. I mean, it all comes down to time and money, but
sure.
I think you're right, because the oral history, I will say, a lot of researchers do go out and use the oral history studio when they can get to Ellis, because, I mean, those are the words of the immigrants, and there's
right.
nothing better.
Right.
Because it's the immediacy of their emotions and remembering what they went through, it's priceless. We have over the years, we had a relationship with AOL for a while where we gave them like a fact of the day, which was really a quote from the oral histories, because they're on audio, but they're also transcribed.
Uh-huh.
So we have them in writing and also in audio. We don't have them in video. But it would be nice to be able to have some audio clips because, you know, then you're hearing it in their voice, and there's nothing to, you know, nothing can beat that.
No, and two, it just, you know, it if you can provide some relation, even if it's just the country of origin, you know, just and not for every search, but every once in a while, you know, just randomly throw out one of these audio
like
tracks. That
you're suggesting within the search process. You're suggesting within the search. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Well.
I mean, just incorporate it. I mean, obviously, the museum, you would be able to get everything, and this would be a random selection. But, you know, it would give that personal. It would, you know, add a lot, I think, to that whole concept of why people are there and what they're looking for, and a better understanding rather than just a record.
Absolutely. No, I think it's a good idea. It's a great resource that we have out there, and it's always good to look at different ways to use them, you know, to
yeah.
bring them to a wider public.
Right, because
that's,
I mean,
the
you
plan.
Know, there are people looking, you know, looking for immigrant ancestors that don't even live in the United States anymore.
Of course. We actually, on our website, we do get a lot of international traffic. We do.
I bet you do.
It's very interesting. And, of course, we have some relationships with, you know, the Red Star Line is creating their own museum in Antwerp. So we have a very pretty active relationship with them. And I just spoke with the German-American Heritage Foundation. I'm going to see or the center in D.C. They're actually opening something this coming fall in D.C., so I'm going to see that person next week. So, yeah, we're very interested in having relationships with these organizations around the world. Because we're telling, you know, they tell the story of people leaving their countries to a great degree, and then they're arriving here. So it's kind of, you know, the feet are straddled. And we do get many international travelers, actually, to Ellis Island in our center. They want to see the part of their family that came here. You know, part of their family maybe came to America and never went back. And they're very interested. And I was out there recently, and there were a couple on the same day, a couple of one was French, one was Italian, and they were moved to tears for finding these records of an aunt, of, you know, a relative that came over here.
Right.
It's fascinating.
Right, that they had heard that had left, and then they'd lost contact, and
exactly,
and their family member was, you know, distraught over that, and they lost contact with them. And I mean, there is an incredible emotion that goes along with this whole process, no matter what side of the pond you're on. And
oh, there is.
I mean, it really is an incredible thing. And I, you know, I do want to make sure that everybody knows that they can reach this database by going to www.ellisisland.org. It's fascinating, and just worth a visit, even if you aren't sure you have anybody that immigrated during that period of time. It's
You know, there's lots to do on the site in addition to just searching our records. And there's a lot of search tips that you can use regardless of what database you're using, you know. You can also get information about the audio tour. EllisIsland.org is kind of our flagship where you can get information about most of what we do. And it does lead over to flagoffaces.org also if you want to learn more about the flag.
Right.
Also, well, we're on Twitter, Statue of Liberty
Twitter?
Ellis Island Foundation. Go to Twitter.
Okay.
Tweet about us. We want your listeners to tweet about us.
Tweet.
Spread the word. Spread the word about the flag.
There you go. I will join, and I will make sure that I do that.
Do that.
I will.
We're trying to do all the things we're supposed to be doing, Susan.
Right.
We're trying to be au courant.
Well, I'm telling you, we've all had to grow with this. They even say Facebook's getting gray because I think we've all suddenly appeared there out of nowhere over the last, 6, 8, 7 months.
Right.
We all have to do that. But I
well,
think
it's a way, you know, and you communicate with different audiences and different medium, and you do, but it's a learning curve, and we're learning, you know, to be perfectly honest, my main problem with some of these things is you can spend a lot of time. It can be a time trap.
They are addictive.
I get twilerts from Twitter, people, you know, commenting or saying something about Ellis Island, and many times it's just that they were visiting Ellis Island, you know.
Right.
But you can really get caught up. But it's good too. It's just another medium for getting the word out and for also hearing what people are saying. It's just important for communication.
Absolutely. You know, I've been enjoying it and getting involved in it, I guess, since sometime in October, November of last year. And it's definitely been an interesting learning curve for all of us. But, Peg, thanks so much for bringing the experience to us today. I know I've been there. I've used the database, but a lot of people have not. And I think it's so very important that this is a, you know, very, 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 very big part of our whole national experience, and looks to be that it's going to be an even more important aspect moving forward.
Even further. And also, one thing I didn't say, Susan, is that 40% of Americans, about 40%, have ancestral records in our database. So, if you know, don't even think if you might, just give it a shot.
There you go.
There's a good chance.
There you go. Anyway, this has been Susan King with Peg Zitko. My website is www.susaneking.com. I'm actually on Facebook under Susan E. King, and also Twitter, Susan E. King. I guess I was very fortunate at my late date of getting involved to be able to get my name, but I did. So,
but you did. Pretty catchy name, too. Lucky you.
Lucky me. But anyway, any event, next week we have a very interesting guest. It's Arthur Kurzweil. He's been very active in genealogy by publishing one of the first books on Jewish genealogy called Generations to Generations. And he also is a Kabbalist, so we're going to really get into some of the spirituality of genealogy next week, and I look forward to you all being with us. Good night. Good day. Good afternoon.